Episode 102, Not Doggies Howl Through Patuxent. Wind and rain blow directly at the window, making the weak plastic screens shiver. Still lion-like in Patuxent. Greetings and welcome into the Patuxent General. I am your host, Jess. We are in the middle of a Harry Houdini marathon. We found so much information that we wanted to share. We needed an extra episode to get it all. This week we have two recipes, chicken paprika and bread pudding with Bing cherries. Then we continue H.P. Lovecraft's Under the Pyramids for Harry Houdini. And Abracapocus. There is also a drink for you to play on your friends. But first, I must thank our Patreon subscribers. These curious mystical people are the water-filled chamber, fabulous assistant, dramatic costume, jam-packed theater, and talented showman that is the magical show that is the Patuxent General, without whom we would merely be a lonely wand on an empty stage. So thank you. If you would like to become one of these celestial superstars, simply click on the link in the show notes or look for the Patuxent General on Patreon.com. Either way, thank you. But until then, let's chat some more about Harry Houdini. I thought it would be fitting to do his favorite dishes. These recipes have been passed down in his family and recorded by his niece. First, let us start with Harry's mother's chicken paprika. Then we'll share Harry's wife Bess' Houdini bread pudding. Thank you at HarryHoudiniCircumstantialEvidence.com. Houdini's chicken paprika from his niece, Marie H. Blood. For this, you will need a heavy skillet, 2.5 pounds frying chicken cut into pieces, 3 medium onions, chopped, 4 tablespoons of butter, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1.5 tablespoons paprika, 1/2 teaspoon sugar, 1 cup flour, 1/4 teaspoon black pepper, 1/4 teaspoon garlic powder, 1/4 teaspoon basil leaves, 1/2 teaspoon salt, and 1 can of tomatoes, undrained, and 1/2 cup white wine. In 2 tablespoons butter, sauté the onions until golden. Remove and set aside. Add the rest of the butter and olive oil to the skillet, and then the paprika and sugar. Heat, mix well, and add the rest of the seasonings to flour in a plastic bag. Add the chicken pieces and coat thoroughly. Add to the hot oil mixture and brown on all sides. Drain off fat from the skillet. Add the tomatoes, broken up with a fork, and wine to the chicken in the skillet. Add the onions and simmer for 4 to 5 minutes until tender. Taste for seasonings, stirring occasionally, and serve over noodles. Enjoy! Houdini's bread pudding from his niece, Marie H. Blood. 6 slices white bread, buttered on one side. 1 quart whole milk. 1 cup sugar. 6 eggs. 1 teaspoon vanilla. Nutmeg. Preheat your oven to 325 degrees and butter a shallow baking dish. Place the bread buttered side up in a single layer in the pan. Scald the milk until bubbling at the edges. In a large bowl, slightly beat the eggs. Add sugar and vanilla and blend gradually. And gently add the milk. Pour over your bread and sprinkle with nutmeg. Place the pan in a larger pan. Pour hot tap water in the larger pan until it comes up to the sides as high as the pudding. Bake at 325 degrees for 40 minutes. Marie says, "My Uncle Harry liked pitted black Bing cherries on top. I use a dollop of strawberry jam on each serving, but it's good plain too. Enjoy." I'm betting that in a magic shop or online, you could find one of these bottles used in this trick. Entertaining at home comes to a whole new level with this. Enjoy performing, think a drink. The concept includes two different drinks, the original Any Drink, where a single container can pour multiple drinks, and the Endless Pour, in which a seemingly large or continuous amount of liquid is poured from a container that is too small to hold it. In the Any Drink, the original method from Hocus Pocus Jr. was a single large barrel that is modified with internal baffles to create three sections. A single spigot on one of the flat ends of the barrel is extended with three pipes, one leading into each different partitions. The flow is controlled through a bunghole on the top that is likewise modified to run to three hoses, each one into each partition. By turning the stopper in the bunghole to uncover one of the pipes, air can flow into the selected partition. When the spigot is opened, only the liquid from the selected partition can flow out. The partial vacuum on the other chambers prevents its flow. The original Any Drink methods using bottles were similar to Hocus Pocus, simply on a smaller scale. Most variations used what appeared to be a bottle, but was actually a tin container, lacquered green to appear like glass. The internal area was divided into sections, and each one empties into a tube that ends just short of the neck. Very small holes drilled into the bottle allow them to be selected in the same fashion as Hocus Pocus, with the magician's hand holding the bottle so their fingers cover the holes. Lifting, one starts the pour. The tea kettle varieties simply moved the holes to the handle. A slight variation on a theme was the magic funnel, which used a two-wall funnel holding liquid between the walls. The magician pours a small amount of liquid through the funnel as normal, but it continues to pour when they lift their finger from a hole in the handle. A very different variation on the Any Drink method uses small packets of dried flavoring or color that can be dropped into the cups before the pour begins. Think a Drink used this at least for some performances, and prior to one show, the seemingly dirty cups were polished by a stagehand and had to be re-prepared. In spite of Hoffman's attempts to protect the act, and perhaps because of it, this is now the basis for the simplest version, the Magic Tea Kettle. This version uses small beads of coloring that are dropped into the cup, preferably during the pour, and the container itself holds water. Most versions contain water only in the bottom of the kettle. The upper portion is a separate container that can be used for a reveal. Other versions may use various simple chemistry to produce the colors. These variations are simple to distinguish because the fluid coming out of the bottle is always the same color, normally clear, while the original method actually has different fluids inside. Break a leg at your next magic-themed cocktail party.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
I want to tell you about my friend Mike and his Electromagnetic Pinball Museum and Restoration Arcade. It's an all-inclusive place to relax and share anything related to modern pinball, EM pinball, and arcade games. A group of pinball and arcade fans with an addiction to games of all kinds and Lego too. $10 gets you free play on pinball and arcade games all day. You can find them at 881 Main Street, Pawtucket, Rhode Island, or online at www.electromagneticpinballmuseum.com. And now it's time for the continued reading of Under the Pyramids by H.P. Lovecraft for Harry Houdini in our continuing series, The House on the Corner. The next morning, we visited the pyramids, riding out in a victoria across the great Nile Bridge with its bronze lions, the island of Gezerah with its massive lebbek trees, and the smaller English bridge to the western shore. Down the shore road we drove, between great rows of lebkas and past the vast zoological gardens to the suburb of Giza, where the new bridge to Cairo proper has since been built. Then, turning inland along the Sharia El Harem, we crossed a region of glassy canals and shabby native villages till before us loomed the objects of our quest, cleaving the mists of dawn and forming inverted replicas in the roadside pools. 40 centuries, as Napoleon had told his campaigners there, indeed, looked down upon us. The road now rose abruptly till we finally reached our place of transfer between the trolley station and the Mena House Hotel. Abdul Reis, who capably purchased our pyramid tickets, seemed to have an understanding with the crowding, yelling, and offensive Bedouins who inhabited a squalid mud village some distance away and pestiferously assailed every traveler, for he kept them very decently at bay and secured an excellent pair of camels for us, himself mounting a donkey, and assigning the leadership of our animals to a group of men and boys more expensive than useful. The area to be traversed was so small that camels were hardly needed, but we did not regret adding to our experience this troublesome form of desert navigation. The pyramids stand on a high rock plateau, this group forming next to the northernmost of the series of regal and aristocratic cemeteries built in the neighborhood of the extinct capital Memphis, which lay on the same side of the Nile, somewhat south of Giza, and which flourished between 3400 and 2000 BC. The greatest pyramid, which lies nearest to the modern road, was built by King Cheops, or Khufu, at about 2800 BC, and stands more than 450 feet in perpendicular height. In the line southwest from this are successively the second pyramid, built a generation later by King Khafre, and though slightly smaller, looking even larger because it's set on higher ground, and the radically smaller third pyramid of King Mycerinus, built in 2700 BC, near the edge of the plateau and due east of the second pyramid, with a face probably altered to form a colossal portrait of Khafre, its royal restorer, stands the monstrous Sphinx. Mute, sardonic, and wise beyond mankind and memory. Minor pyramids and traces of the ruined minor pyramids are found in several places, and the whole plateau is pitted with the tombs of dignitaries of less than royal rank. These latter were originally marked by mastabas, or stone bench-like structures, about the deep burial shafts, as found in other Memphian cemeteries and exemplified by Pernab's tomb in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. At Giza, however, all such visible things have been swept away by time and pillage, and only the rock-hewn shafts, either sand-filled or cleared out by archaeologists, remain to attest their former existence. Connected with each tomb was a chapel in which priests and relatives offered food and prayer to the hovering Ka, or vital principle of the deceased. The small tombs have their chapels contained in their stone mastabas, or superstructures, but the mortuary chapels of the pyramids, where regal pharaohs lay, were separate temples, each to the east of its corresponding pyramid and connected by a causeway to a massive gate chapel, or propylon, at the edge of the rock plateau. The gate chapel leading to the second pyramid, nearly buried in the drifting sands, yawns subterraneously southeast of the Sphinx. Persistent tradition dubs it the Temple of the Sphinx. and it may be rightly called such, if the Sphinx indeed represents the second pyramid's builders, Khafre. There are unpleasant tales of the Sphinx before Khafre, but whatever its elder features were, the monarch replaced them with his own, that men might look upon the colossus without fear. It was in the great Gateway Temple that the life-size diorite statue of Khafre, now in the Cairo Museum, was found, a statue before which I stood in awe when I beheld it. Whether the whole edifice is now excavated, I am not certain. But in 1910, most of it was below ground, with its entrance heavily barred at night. Germans were in charge of the work, and the war or other things may have stopped them. I would give much in view of my experience and of certain Bedouin whisperings discredited and unknown in Cairo to know what had developed in connection with a certain well in a transverse gallery where statues of the pharaoh were found in curious juxtaposition to the statues of baboons. The road, as we traversed it on our camels that morning, curved sharply past the wooden police quarters, post office, drugstore, and shops on the left, and plunged south and east in a complete bend that scaled the rock plateau and brought us face to face with the desert under the lee of the Great Pyramid. Past Cyclopean masonry we rode, rounding the eastern face and looking down ahead into a valley of minor pyramids, beyond which the eternal Nile glistened to the east and to the eternal desert shimmered to the west. Very close loomed the three major pyramids, the greatest devoid of outer casing and shewing its bulk of great stones, but the others retaining here and there the neatly fitted covering which had made them smooth and finished in their day. Presently we descended towards the Sphinx and sat silent beneath the spell of those terrible, unseeing eyes. On the vast stone breast we faintly discerned the emblem of Ra Harakhte, for whose image the Sphinx was mistaken in the late dynasty. And though sand covered the tablet between the great paws, we recalled what Thutmosis IV inscribed thereon and the dream he had when a prince. It was then that the smile of the Sphinx vaguely displeased us and made us wonder about the legends of subterranean passages beneath the monstrous creature, leading down, down to depths none might dare hint at, depths connected with mysteries older than the dynastic Egypt we now excavate, and having a sinister relation to the persistence of abnormal animal-headed gods in the ancient Nilotic pantheon. Then, too, it was I asked myself an idle question whose hideous significance was not to appear for many an hour. Other tourists now began to overtake us, and we moved on to the sand-choked temple of the Sphinx, 50 yards to the southeast, which I have previously mentioned as the great gate to the causeway of the second period's mortuary chapel on the plateau. Most of it was still underground, and although we dismounted and descended through a modern passageway to an alabaster corridor and pillared hall, I felt that Abdul and the local German attendant had not shown us all there was to see. After this, we made the conventional circuit of the pyramid plateau, examining the second pyramid and the peculiar ruins of its mortuary chapel to the east, and the third pyramid and its miniature southern satellites and ruined eastern chapel, the rock tombs and honeycombings of the fourth and fifth dynasties, and the famous Campbell's tomb, whose shadowy shaft sinks precipitously for 53 feet to a sinister sarcophagus, which one of our camel drivers divested of the cumbering sand after a vertiginous descent by rope. Cries now assailed us from the Great Pyramid, where Bedouins were besieging a party of tourists with offers of guidance to the top, or of displays of speed in the performance of solitary trips up and down. 7 minutes is said to be the record for such an ascent and descent, but many lusty sheiks and sons of sheiks assured us that they could cut it to 5 if given the requisite impetus of liberal backsheesh. They did not get this impetus. Although we did let Abdul take us up, thus obtaining a view of the unprecedented magnificence, which included not only remote and glittering Cairo, with its crowned citadel and background of gold violet hills, but all the pyramids of the Memphian district as well. From Abu Rosh to the north to the Dasher in the south. The Saqqara Step Pyramid, which marks the evolution of the low mastaba into the true pyramid, showed clearly and alluringly in the sandy distance. It is close to this transition monument that the famed tomb of Pernab was found, more than 400 miles north of the Theban rock valley where Tutankhamun sleeps. Again, I was forced to silence through sheer awe. The prospect of such antiquity and the secrets each hoary monument seemed to hold and brood over filled me with a reverence and sense of immensity nothing else ever gave me. Fatigued by our climb and disgusted with the Bedouins whose actions seemed to defy every rule of taste, we omitted the arduous detail of entering the cramped interior passages of any of the pyramids, though we saw several of the hardiest tourists preparing for the suffocating crawl through Cheops' mightiest memorial. As we dismissed and overpaid our local bodyguard and drove back to Cairo with Abdul Reis under the afternoon sun, we half regretted the omission we had made. Such fascinating things were whispered about lower pyramid passages not in the guidebooks, passages whose entrances had been hastily blocked up and concealed by certain uncommunicative archaeologists who had found and begun to explore them. Of course, this whispering was largely baseless on the face of it, but it was curious to reflect how persistently visitors were forbidden to enter the pyramids at night, or to visit the lowest burrows and crypt of the Great Pyramid. Perhaps, in the latter case, it was the psychological effect which was feared, the effect on the visitor of feeling himself huddled down beneath a gigantic world of solid masonry, joined to the life he had known by the merest tube in which he may only crawl, and which any accident or evil design might block. The whole subject seemed so weird and alluring that we resolved to pay the Pyramid Plateau another visit on the earliest possible opportunity. And for me, this opportunity came much earlier than I expected. Thank you once again for joining us today at the Patuxent General. If you would like to reach out with a recipe, local ghost story, a special order, or question, our email is jess@patuxentgeneral.com. Please reach out. We can't wait to hear from you, and we'll get back to you as soon as possible. But until then, I'll meet you right back here next time at the Patuxent General. A Something for Posterity production, pre-recorded in Patuxent.